Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Lumieres podcast. My name is Jody White, and thank you for tuning in. This is part two of my conversation with the very charismatic Bob Robery. The first episode was last week. I hope you've enjoyed that. And this one is just the summation of our chat. As I mentioned last week, Bob is the subject of Ian Marchant's new book, A Hero for High Times, which comes out on the 16th of February. And I actually got the chance to sit down with Ian last week, and we recorded a podcast too. So it's there's a lovely flow to the way these last few episodes have been going. There's Bob, and then there's Ian, who wrote the book. And funnily enough, I'm going to try and release the new one with Ian on the same day that his book comes out, which is all very lovely timing. So I do hope you enjoy this conversation with Bob. Of course, there are several tales and very hairy stories to come. If you enjoyed it, please get in touch and let me know in whatever way that works for you. I'm going to revamp the social media side of this podcast just to see if we can get it out there a little bit more, which means things like Twitter, which I'd sort of stopped using. I'm going to reactivate. The Twitter is at Lumieres Podcast. On Facebook, it's the same, facebook.com/Lumieres Podcast. I'm going to make special pages for both of those, which just contain links to all the episodes that have been out so far. Same on Instagram. I'm going to make a special Instagram just for podcast posts. So it's all very condensed and easy to find. And you don't have to wade through my own personal Instagram feeds or whatever to get the episodes that you want to find. So I'll put all those up at the website with this post, but just to reiterate, basically just search Lumieres Podcast and you'll find it. I think the Instagram one is the Lumieres Podcast, so just with the in front of it, you'll find it there. I'm going to have all the episode links up there. Thank you once again for listening. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. Last night I went to see one of my favourite singers of recent years, Jessica Hoop, play live. And she was fantastic, absolutely fantastic. And there was a track off her latest record called Memories Are Now, actually the title track, Memories Are Now. And something about this, I really felt to put it up and to play it before the rest of this conversation with Bob. I could have easily put it in last week's, but we got a little bit of a shorter episode with the second part, so I felt to put it in today. And it's a very pertinent track to the themes of Bob's life and what we've been talking about here with adventure and living in the moment. So I'm going to drop this in before we go into the end of the chat with Bob. I'll put the video up on the website as well. Jessica's such a fantastic talent. She's got a really unique way with phrasing, a mind-blowing voice, amazing songwriting skills. She's just great. And I was blown away by her live. She takes it to another level. You can find her at www.jessicahoop.com. Find her Bandcamp page, there's all her music's on there, and please go and buy some of it. It's all pretty wonderful stuff. I think that's everything for today, so have a great week, wherever you are, whatever you're doing. Hello to all the people in various countries around the world that are still tuning into this. Thank you so much. Please tell all your friends. Let's pump this up a little bit. And I'll see you on February the 16th with Mr. Ian Marchant himself. Cheers.
Through, no matter what you say, I shame on you. You've got this idea, I can be fooled again with the light. Shame on me, clear the way. I'm coming through, no matter what you say. I've got work to be doing. If you're not here to help, go find some other life to rule in. You have outstayed your welcome. Best get up, get on, get moving. Get moving, get moving, get moving. Let me show you the good.
I mean, it's in a way, it's like a whole new adventure coming to live in Wales.
Oh, definitely, yeah, no doubt about it.
Was that kind of, did that mark sort of an end to your travelling adventures? Or were you more based up here then, or did you take any other?
No, because lived there in the house for a few years, not many years, I know, 2 or 3 years.
Yeah,
and had loads of adventures down there with the mate. Who had a motorcycle magazine, had come down pretty well every week with a trailer full of brand new motorbikes for us to just razz around the hills. Of course, the house we were was on a hill, sort
right,
of thing.
Right,
so
right,
we had
right.
to go through one gate, our gate,
yeah.
And we're on the hill.
Wow.
Which can, you know, go for fucking miles.
Yeah.
And you know, these were dirt bikes he was bringing down, not road bikes. They were all dirt bikes. So, you know, that's adventure. And
that sounds great.
We had an adventure which perhaps I shouldn't talk to you about because it's a bit fucking airy. Well, it's bound to be in the book, which is just over there.
Okay.
Well, the second most wanted man in the British Isles was there, armed up.
Oh, my God.
And we were on the wrong side of a recent bit of action.
Okay.
So...
Ooh, that doesn't sound like it's going to add up to...
There were some sticky moments like that. And there was also some of our fucking funniest things.
Let's leave...
I will tell you the story in full detail later. I will see what how Ian has put it in the book.
Yeah, let's leave it for the book for now. Maybe we can talk about that. Like, how did the book... how did you come to meet Ian and how did the book idea come into being?
I'd seen Ian a couple of times just on the scene in Prestine. I was more Prestine orientated than social life, I think. And I was living in a house at the time over the road in a village, New Adna, and I was going up onto the forest tracks, and if you've only got to go a mile or so up the road, and then off onto a smaller road, and I knew, I heard this bloke lived up, so Ian, who you just met, I knew he lived up on a house, one of the houses up there, there's only one, in fact, the only house you passed up that road. I was going out there, I had a sawn-off 410 shotgun, which I used to shoot rabbits from a motorbike with a Honda 90, so you didn't need your
as you do
left hand.
Yeah,
well, it was more fun than, you know, it was just anyway. So I was going up, there was this, you know, sort of short shotgun in my belt, sort of thing. And there's Ian standing outside, so I stopped as I pulled it out and pointed it. It was not loaded when I pointed it.
Good.
So I said some, you know, light-hearted thing or whatever, you know. And, you know, the mate immediately put it away. But I didn't want him to think I was actually threatening. I was just having a laugh, you know, ha-ha. Yeah.
Did he appreciate it?
Yeah, he loved it. No, I mean, if I saw it, he would have taken it amiss. I wouldn't have done it.
So that's how you first met him?
Yeah.
And then how did the idea for this book come about? I guess I should be asking him, I guess.
Well, he's a writer. And the writers are looking for subjects. And I like telling my stories. So presumably someone on the line, I'd told him enough stories. I think it was the one that somehow came into conversation, Focalarum, the band, old band that used to be.
Yeah, I remember them, yeah.
Well, and I told him, yeah, they were named after my cat. and he didn't believe it. Anyway, he checked it out, because he checks things out nowadays.
Yeah.
And found out, it was true, you know. Because one of the things, I'm not a very good liar. I don't like lying. Unless you really, really have to.
Yeah.
Don't lie. Always tell exactly the truth.
That's a good motto.
Anyway, he found out, you know, that was actually a fact. And because it had been researched by somebody else in the past, and yes, it nailed it down, yeah, and yes, it was substantiated and blah-de-blah. And then I started, you know, telling him stories about the travels in the East and that, and he thought it was worth a book. And in fact, so did a bloke called Sam Llewellyn, do you know? A local writer who writes really good books on the sea and sailing and islands. They're good reads, all of them. Anyway, he was interested in doing the same thing, but I don't know, if some reason I went for Ian. We'll see.
How was the experience for that, for the years? Did it consist of like a lot of you know, conversations? And...
Well, a lot of me telling me stories, you know, which I like to do.
Yeah.
Simple as that. So, I mean, it wasn't any hardship for me sitting there in here over the space of several years. It's taken about 5 or 6 years to write.
Wow, okay, yeah.
It's huge. It's longer than War and Peace. I'm not kidding.
Really? That sounds like quite a piece of work then. And that's coming out next year, is that right? Or is it already out now?
No, I've got a publisher's proof sort of copy on my bed there, but it won't be published, won't come out on the streets till I think the 15th of February.
February.
Day after Valentine's Day.
Oh, perfect. Good little gift.
It was supposed to be coming out early January, but for some reason they've changed their mind. I don't know.
Yeah.
Where that is.
Have you, I mean, it's an interesting thing to be a subject of a book.
It's a bit strange, yeah.
Yeah.
But it has a really good side, and the main reason I was happy that it should go ahead, because it's always been my ambition, not ambition, plan, to do an autobiography.
Ah, brilliant.
Because, and I thought, well, I should imagine if you're totally unheard of, getting your foot in a publisher's door, maybe because I've got social graces that some people just don't take to. You know? I mean, and maybe people in offices are generally that sort of people.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I thought, well, if someone writes a biography, on my life, and it's published and liked, well, this makes it fucking hell of a lot easier to get your own sort of thing done, yeah? And funny enough, about a few weeks ago, when Ian was in here again, I said, look, if you ever get the chance to, like, whoever your deal was at Capes, if you just, you know, lightly mention, don't make an issue of it, just lightly mention or ask, would they be interested in a... He said, they've already asked if there is a possibility of such a thing.
Wow, amazing.
Really.
How cool is that? That's awesome.
Well, it's a fucking good start, isn't it?
That's great, yeah. That's really interesting. So do you reckon you'll be able to try and make the transition into a writing and it being a bit of an author?
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah,
well,
I can see it.
I mean, I haven't got any of the literary skills or tricks, but I have read a lot. I still read a lot as a child, and I still do.
I think that's so important.
I do have some idea of how to string a sentence together.
Yeah.
I don't know about split infinitives, and I don't fucking care.
But that's not your job, really, in a way, is it? Like, you know, there's plenty of people who can edit.
Here's some of my jewellery, yeah? Now, proper jewellers look at my jewellery and say, but you can see where the joins are. Doesn't that bother you? Not at all.
It's beautiful. And what's this made from?
What, silver and stones?
That's lovely. So how did you learn to make jewellery?
Just taught myself.
Did you?
Yeah. First time I ever did any jewellery work at all, where I certainly never had any thought to do it afterwards, was in Baghdad, oddly. I was out there to buy rugs of a particular type when Baghdad was... It wasn't where they were made, but where there was a lot
sold
of them gathered, sort of thing. There was a market for them. So I was, you know, obviously spending time in the bazaar, wandering about, looking for good examples of these particular rugs. And I literally was getting, I don't know, psychic belts. You're just shocks. Of course, you know, well, our bazaars, you know, colours and smells and bloody blah.
Pretty intense.
But occasionally there was sort of open-fronted stalls, rooms. So like a small room with a completely open front, you know, shutters or something, or doors that closed them when they... And they were all very much the same. They had a picture of a guy on the wall with a white beard and a green turban. A guy working on a small charcoal brazier, or just sort of sitting there. It'd have a box, and that's pretty well it. You know, austere, you know, as sort of austere could be, sort of thing, absolutely. And nothing, no sign of anything for sale, no goods, merchandise, or anything. It was... But I knew these were... This is important. These are important. Anyway, the third one of those, I found... I was new in Iraq, had literally not a word of Arabic, or maybe three, you know, sort of. And the guy I spoke to had not a word of English. But after establishing that fact, he went on to tell me... Because I demanded of him, who are you guys, sort of thing. And he replied, we are the followers of the same church that John the Baptist went to. Maybe the Essenes, I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. And our particular sect, we must all work silver near running water. Now, as you know, Baghdad's got the Tigris and the Euphrates fucking running through it and all around it, yeah. So they're definitely...
In the right place.
And anyway, just because, you know, he's going to a lot of effort. And now how he got all this over to me, I have no fucking idea. I mean, yeah. But I understood it all. I was obviously meant to. And he said, do you want to have a go of what he was doing? What he was doing, he was making ring shanks, you know, the bit of the ring before you put the stone and the whatever's going on, the top bit of it, yeah.
Okay.
Presumably he's making... because that's all he was doing. He was so he was presumably passing them on to another craftsman who would then put the other bits on. Uh-huh. And he was using a blowpipe. It's the old way of sort of like heating small amounts of metal jewellery.
Right.
You have a car aerial thickness tube that tapering down to literally a pinprick hole sort mm-hmm. of thing, a large pinprick. When you blow down that on the charcoal, you've got the material that you want to get hot enough
really
to solder
yeah.
on the top of the charcoal. You just blow it and move it about maybe, and then you apply a bit of solder and solder the top of it together. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I did that. And thought no more about it for several years. But during those several years, I'd already acquired in Afghanistan a number of these.
Oh, right.
They're dyes for me. So quite a lot of the jewellery that you looked at in there are made using those dyes. Now, I had no idea what they were when I was buying them. I hadn't a clue. They were just fascinating bits of metal.
Yeah, they are.
And I thought, right, I can take them back to England and make them into belt buckles. And because it was the 60s then,
yeah.
when such things would have been.
People
yeah,
were
yeah,
into
yeah,
that.
People would have gone
yeah,
for that.
Yeah, yeah.
Fortunately, I didn't do that. Because the very last trip I made out there, which was flying out there, and I saw a guy in the bazaar using them.
Ah.
So I sat down and watched him do it and, you know, sort of learnt how to do that. Still with no thought to actually doing it.
Yeah.
But well, you can see I did.
Yeah, you've...
No, why I got into jewellery, which I'd have never in a thousand years thought to do off my own bat, I was in bed after a pretty bad motorbike smash with a cracked open head, two limbs in plaster and other bits broken and that. And absolutely no money at all. I'd scrounged a mattress in a broom cupboard under the stairs in a junkie household. Not all that literal truth. And knew it wasn't ideal, but under the circumstances, the best I could get together sort of thing. So you make the best of that. And it was okay. No, it was friendly people, obviously. Anyway, I'd get visitors, and Monica, the girl I'd done the clothes with in Afghanistan,
yeah.
she turned up one day, and I said, you know, I asked her if she had any idea how I could earn any dosh, yeah, because I was totally skint, and like, I wasn't trying to scrounge anything, but I just, you know, literally was trying to think of any way I could earn money. She said, oh, why don't you try something like jewellery? And I knew fuck all about making jewellery, except I did know how to silver solder. And I had worked as an apprentice engineer, so I knew a little bit about metalwork and had a certain amount of tools for working on motorbikes, which aren't ideal, but some of them are used, you know, pliers and that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So why don't you try something like jewellery? So I said, well, then it's a fiver, go down to West End, because this is in London, go into the West End and spend it on some silver. And my current girlfriend worked in a shop on the King's Road in Chelsea. First thing I made, a single earring, she put in the shop, sold same day, and that continued. I'd make earrings and she'd put them in the shop and they'd sell straight away.
That's amazing.
So suddenly I was a jeweller.
It's another adventure of its own, that, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it taught me a lot. It taught me patience, which I wasn't very, very good at.
Mm.
Didn't like being told what to do, and I didn't like waiting for people, or I didn't like anything that didn't go exactly how I wanted it to.
We've all been there, I'm sure.
I'm sure, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, the jewellery did teach me patience by throwing something on the floor. Then, God, I really need that thing that's 2 mil or 3 mil big, and you've got to find
tools.
A bloody thing because need to finish that ring or earring. Because you need to sell it and get the money so you can eat tomorrow, sort of thing.
So is that how do you, is that kind of, obviously that's one of the ways you spend your time these days. So is that, how do you, what's a normal day look like for you if there is such a thing?
What, now?
Yeah, now.
I get up when pretty, you know, somewhere after 10, usually a bit before 11 sort of thing. And, of course, the situation is I don't need to earn money anymore.
Yeah.
I get more than I need from the government.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And this land is something that you
use?
Yeah, so you have an agreement with the landowner.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Perfect.
Yeah. He doesn't charge me any rent, and any trees that fall over or, you know, drop on or overhang the neighbouring fields, I just deal with, and don't trouble him with it, you know, sort of thing. And I've made tracks all over the place, so if he wants to get around in there, he can.
He can, sort of yeah.
Not that he ever does, you know. I've seen him about twice this year.
Wow.
He only lives a mile and a half up the road. So,
yeah. But I guess that suits you, eh? Yeah.
Not half.
Yeah, it's incredible. And like,
no, I used to have, it's odd, I used to have like the sin in, I lived with a woman across the road in New Adna. And one of the arrangements I had with her, I will keep her in firewood, sort of thing. Which I was just, you know, going and stealing it from wherever I could, basically. But until then, anyway, I heard that you could do deals with the Forestry Commission on small woodlands, that you could buy the sinins.
Yeah.
They'd come in and blaze, you know, cut, you know, a mark on the trees that they wanted cut and gone. You'd give them a very small amount of money. You know, I think 18 quid I gave them or something.
Wow.
It wasn't very much at all.
Yeah.
Anyway, and you have to pull out all these, you know, trees. This was before all health and safety got on the act.
Yeah.
You could just turn up there, you know, just dressed like I am, the chainsaw and
just
drag them out,
trees.
You know, on me back. So, literally, I mean. But that fucked me back up pretty bad, actually.
Yeah.
But then I got a machine, you know, similar to that one over there, but better than that, actually, the next stage up, a two-cylinder dumper than a one-cylinder dumper, which I altered, and that's how I could, you know, operate it. Yeah. That made life easier. Anyway, I was parked up in a lay-by with a chainsaw wood carver mate, Sir Harry Thomas. Did you come across him?
Not yet.
He now lives across the valley there. But in the days when we'd all living on the road, sort of thing, up near Gloucester way somewhere, and we pulled up in a big lay-by with our workout on display, sort of thing, and car pulled up. And I'd seen the couple who got out of it. I knew them. The guy was a guitarist and also a vet, and I heard he'd bought the farm above Water Breaks Its Neck, just up the road here.
Yeah.
Anyway, they come into my van for a chat, and the woman says, "You're the bloke who makes these hooks, aren't you? The cup hooks." I said, "Yeah, I make a lot of cup hooks. It's one of my main sources of revenue." He said, "Oh, how do I get the wire from? Because it's all beautiful, pitted, and, you know, looks very old." I said, "Yes, like, most of it comes from an old railway fence. Runs alongside a wood near New Radnor." He said, "What, you don't mean Frostal wood?" I said, "Yeah, but how did you know that? Because you've only moved in here, and people who were born in this, you know, just across the road from it, don't know what it's called." He said, "Oh, because we own it." said I. Because the Forestry Commission had sold it. Someone else had bought it.
Okay.
And they had bought it off that person,
right.
Sort of thing.
Right.
So it had gone through like a lot of changes. It was a plantation, like when I was, it was a row of firs and a row of broadleafs, all alternating. And anyway, not many seconds passed before I said, "Do you mind if I park up here now and again?" And that led to them saying, I mean, like not immediately, but some while after I'd parked up here quite a lot, they said, "Look, as far as we're concerned, you can stay here the rest of your life."
Wow.
So I was, okay. All right.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, that's brilliant, isn't it? Like,
sure,
such, like, it's really nice of them to offer you that.
They only bought the wood as a investment. Yeah?
Okay.
So I'm not taking anything away from it, and also the fact that I have actually been living here now for the best part of 10 years, this probably work if they ever want to get building things on it. And of course, the way it's going, oh, we need affordable homes and blah, blah, blah. Mind you, so much bullshit and bollocks connected with that. It's hardly worth talking ridiculous. Or thinking about. But what is worth doing is having a pee when you need one.
How do you find, though, like, what do you make of technology in the way that, like, because obviously for someone who's living as you live, you're on your own in the woods and you've got, you're kind of surrounded by nature and there's that kind of inherent beauty and peace about that, you know. How do you feel, how does technology kind of come into your life, this way that we're all connected through these little boxes now, and it's such a, you know, it's such a weird thing in a way.
Yeah, but something you've got sort of taking the stride. I haven't dived into the cyber world wholeheartedly. In fact, I've only just a couple of days ago got, my daughter got me into Amazon. I've got these bulbs, look at that. 5 watts. Yeah, that is a 5 watt fucking bulb.
That's a lot of light.
That is a lot of light for 5 watts in it.
Well, that's technology you can use.
Yeah, well, obviously, yeah. I mean, I had bulbs, you know, same sort of thing, but not as bright as that, which was only using actually three watts.
Wow. It's amazing. You don't need a lot, do you? Really?
You don't need a lot.
No. No, it's fantastic.
And the background I come from was dirt poor, really poor. You know, if we lived in America, we'd have been called trailer trash sort of thing. Really dirt poor trailer trash. So we weren't living in trailers, but that's social level was, you know, pretty well near the bottom as you can get sort of thing, without actually being vagrant.
Mm-hmm.
But I read a lot. I was obviously totally fucking insane and should have been locked up. Well, no, I think the things I used to do. You know, one of my favourite things to do, I mean, you'll perhaps not believe this, but it's absolutely fact. Near to where I live is a place called Ash Ranges. It was only about 3 miles away as the crow flies, and that's a way of, my preferred way of direction of travelling.
Yeah.
So I could get to them without going on a road, basically. I could just cross a field, cross a railway line, through a small wood, cross a Basingstoke Canal, and you're most of the way there, then it's over a bit of army land, and there's the Ash Ranges. And it was in the days when they still had national service, yeah? So there's hundreds of soldiers, yeah? And
wow.
And it was very near Aldershot where I lived, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So that land was the testing playground for the British Army. And it was like thousands of acres, you know, many thousands of acres. It was huge. But the Rangers were where they'd teach, you know, the lads to shoot rifles and machine guns, light and medium. And have you ever seen an army shooting range?
No.
Okay. There's the targets are on a big bank of earth, about twice as high as this van sort of thing, and much wider. On the shooter's side of that bank of earth, there is a sort of concrete trench with the chain hoisted targets. They're about that big square. And they're pulled up and down on these metal frames by chains.
Mm-hmm.
And the people are doing that, obviously, are well protected, you know, with their heads several feet below the bullets. Anyway, people in the target area could not see up the range at all, obviously, mm-hmm. because, you know. And the shooters couldn't see people in the target area. Nor could they see, and the shooters were shooting from a mound of earth only about, from the ground about this high.
Yeah, so that's what, a metre and a half or something?
Yeah. And there was a long bank of earth. And every 50 yards there was one of these going back to, you know, quite a long way. And generally they shot from about 3 or 4 of these mounds of earth back, you know, so about 200 yards, normal sort of battlefield sort of range. And because, you know, I was good at creeping through the bracken and heather sort of thing on my belly sort of thing, because I was good at it. And anyway, I could get in to the under the cover of the bracken earth without anyone seeing me. I could get into between, you know, two banks of earth.
Oh God.
With no shooters on, obviously.
Yeah.
The shooters were, you know,
on the next one,
not 50 yards away, sort of thing. And the thrill to me was, go along there a bit. You didn't have to go far. Just to do about, you know, about a third, quarter of the way across. And then get as near to the top as you could without, but knowing you were still protected, yeah? Because, you know, and yeah, if they were firing machine guns or, you know, fuck me, or even just rifles, if you... dozens of bullets hissing through the air, literally about that far away from
you.
Oh,
my God.
Well, that to me was the biggest
thrill. That was the height of excitement.
Yeah. And adding to it was the fact was how apeshit they would go if they found me there.
God.
If there was no shooters there, at the range, you know, because you'd tell from a long way away because you'd hear the fucking guns going off. I'd generally have a bag with me that, and I'd collect the spent bullets that had hit the target bank of earth because one of the sources of income when I was a child was lead. Ah. I'd learned that lead was worth money.
Some money.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and I knew that the 303 bullets that all the weapons are used in both... the rifle, the Bren gun and the Vickers machine gun all use the same ammunition, which I thought was one of the few smart things I've British military do, yes, have the same bullets. For the rifles, the light machine guns and the medium machine guns all take the same ammunition.
Yeah.
Very fucking sensible.
Yeah.
Anyway, but they were copper-coated lead. And it's easy enough to extract the lead from the copper by just putting in a saucepan or a big old tin can and put it on a fire and all the lead would melt out of it. I had no idea that copper was worth anything at the time. But and I knew, well, there's loads of sort of pikey scrap people about the area, so it was very easy to sell the lead.
Yeah, yeah.
So, so that was one way of getting money.
Just one way, yeah, yeah.
One of the best way was bowls. Funny enough, it's strange, but a quart cider bottle, which were quite common in them days, glass quart screw top cider bottle, was a 2 shilling deposit on them. Now, that doesn't like 10p. Now, that doesn't sound a lot, but when I first started work, I didn't earn 2 shillings in an hour. I earned 1 9p. That's, you know, less than 2 shillings an hour. So a 2 shilling deposit on a fucking bottle, wow. Result, you know, sort of thing. Well, if you consider an hour's hard work is what you'd have to earn and more to even raise that deposit, let alone the cider in the bottle,
that
sort of thing, which probably wasn't much more than fucking 2 shillings. In fact, it might have been the deposit was more than the actual contents,
if you
know what I mean. Well, I'm sure you do. anyway, that was... and finding soldiers' shagging grounds was another good source of income because there's all these soldiers about and they'd presumably find bunches of oars from somewhere. I don't know. Sort of, they have to be pretty racy sort of girls to them. And you'd find a depressed area of usually some old shell or bomb crater that had grown over and looked all nice and sheltered and that. And it was easy to spot these places because the undergrowth was all flattened. And there'd be loads of rubber johnnies and jam rags, you know, the old style sanitary towels.
Yeah.
So you'd see them scattered about the place. So it was a sure sign that a lot of people have been there with their trousers down. And when blokes pull their trousers down and it's generally dark in those sort of situations, well, changing that falls out of their pockets, doesn't it? As it does when people are sitting in trains, which was the reason we used to take buy a sort of, I don't know, 4p or whatever it was, hardly any money, ticket from railway station to Aldershot station, and then travel the whole length of the line to Alton, to Waterloo, then to Aldershot and get off with our valid ticket, having ducked down from probably several ticket inspectors on the way, to go down the seats for the money.
Yeah, ah, okay.
Clever. And, you know, having the trip through, day on the train, sort of thing, for swims or whatever it was.
So the ability to spot an opportunity seems like a skill of yours, Bob.
Possibly, yeah. Well, and acting on it.
Yeah.
There's not so good at spotting it if you don't do anything about it. Yeah, so.
Completely.
Actions speak louder than words.
Indeed, indeed.
Anyway, put your fucking kit away, though.
We found our way.